I'm Nick Harvey Doyle, an Ngunnawan man from the northern tablelands of New South Wales. The Yarn podcast is made on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung, and Bunurong people. We'd like to acknowledge First Nations people as the first storytellers. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
From the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne, this is The Yarn. I'm Elliot Rodriguez. Today, we're returning to our News Bites series. It spotlights the work of staff and students at the Center for Advancing Journalism. This week's guest is podcaster, PhD candidate, and former journalism student Dylan Bird. You might recognize his voice from Triple R's Future Perfect program, which Dylan hosts. He also works behind the scenes on the Cash podcast Masterclass. On top of this, he's currently completing a PhD about how podcasts can maintain democracy. He spoke to senior tutor Bernadette Nunn about producing audio stories, hosting live radio, and the political potential of podcasting. Bernadette Nunn started by asking Dylan how he saw his journalism career unfolding back when he was still a student.
Yeah, well, I'd sort of done a little bit of freelancing before then, mainly sort of print journalism. I'd done a little bit of reporting around the Goulburn Valley, reporting on sort of migration and employment issues in that part of the world. And as part of my studies when I was a master's student, this was back in 2012, 2013, I also did a stint in Indonesia, a placement over there working with Tempo magazine, which is kind of a long-form weekly current affairs mag. And at that point, I really thought I wanted to be a print journalist, primarily. And, you know, like a lot of people had dreams of maybe being a foreign correspondent and that sort of thing. And then I suddenly discovered radio sort of towards the middle part of that master's degree, I suppose. And it just unlocked this whole other world that I kind of wasn't aware of. Like, I'd listened to radio a bit before, but hadn't really discovered like the magic of a radio feature, a radio documentary. And this was a time before podcasting really had its moment with Serial, that massive breakout hit in 2014. And so I just had a lot of fun starting to make radio packages as part of that, and then thought, oh, I really want to do more of this.
I think also your studies partly introduced you to that magic of radio. Mm. But you'd also done another internship as well as the long-form investigative work you did in Indonesia. What was the other internship you did that maybe also helped rule out what maybe you didn't want to do?
Yeah, well, I did an internship at The Age for about, I think, 3 weeks or a month or something like that. And I mean, I was really trying to just get as many different experiences as I could. But I kind of thought that would be a place I'd want to work as a daily news journalist. But for whatever reason, you know, I didn't come out of that thinking I really want to pursue this. I thought, oh, that was a good experience, but I kind of want to try out some other things at least first and maybe, you know, come back to some of those major mastheads potentially. But something about the daily news churn didn't appeal to me, and it might have been that my skills lend themselves more to long form sort of stuff and that's kind of more where my interest lies. But it was good to get that experience and not necessarily rule it out, but to find that wasn't something I felt really passionate about pursuing, at least at that point in time.
So having fallen in love with radio instead, what did you do with that drive and that sort of new interest?
Well, I started volunteering at Triple R around then. So I thought, all right, I want to sort of get my hands dirty with this. And
maybe just start and explain what Triple R is for those who might not know.
Good point. Yeah. So Triple R is a community radio station based up in Brunswick here in Melbourne. It started back in 1976. So around the time when there were a lot of community radio licenses given to sort of new stations around Australia, and has had sort of a very proud history. I suppose initially started out of RMIT, very much aligned with kind of counterculture, sort of the punk music movement in those kind of years, but it's always had, I guess, a progressive kind of ethos, and has really championed, you know, alternative views, ways of looking at the world, and has been very proud of that kind of legacy and identity, I guess. But it's grown to be one of the most substantial community radio stations, if not the biggest in Australia. Has a very large subscriber base, does probably around about maybe 60-70% sort of music programming. Then the rest of it is talks based, some specialist shows, some more general. I mean, I got involved as a volunteer, really just wanting to get a feel for how the station worked and get involved in radio in some way. But I'd listened to the station and sort of my parents had for a while before then, and I didn't think that, you know, being on air is something that I'd necessarily do, or at least very quickly. But I found once you sort of walk through the doors, there are lots of opportunities if you want to take them. And so after probably a matter of months, I did the broadcaster training course. And then what happens is you do a graveyard shift. So you're on air from sort of, you know, 2 till 6 in the middle of the night, a space where you can make mistakes and the consequences aren't too grave. And then pretty quickly, I started helping out behind the scenes for a current affairs show on Monday morning. And one of the co-hosts stepped off and I basically stepped in, long story short. And co-hosted that show for many years until this year, where my former co-host stepped off and I've gone solo with the new show, Future Perfect.
When you first walked in, what were you doing first of all? And I guess then how do you get to be behind the microphone? And how important was it to understand some of those other roles that it takes to get a radio program to air?
Very important also to, I guess, respect and acknowledge all the amount of work that goes into making a show happen that's not just the person sitting behind the microphone. So my first role, I think it was writing social media highlights for interviews that had gone to air. So, you know, we'd write a little synopsis of them. We'd post it out via whatever, Facebook, Twitter, whatever else was around at that point. And so I'd come in for a few hours each week. There'd be maybe 4 or 5 different interviews that had happened. I'd listen to them, write up a little synopsis, then put it out into the world, basically. So I did that. Then I started doing things like adding playlists to the website. When I started assisting with the show that I became the co-host of, I was helping with writing sort of rundowns for the show, chatting to guests off air, making sure they were all comfortable, that sort of warm-up stuff, and then transitioned to being on air from then.
So first time on air, how did you feel?
Super nervous. My parents listened at 2 in the morning, which didn't make me feel any more comfortable. Yeah, I remember every time I hit the button on the desk and the red light went on, this jolt of panic would shoot through me. And I'd just be so worried about what I'd say, whether I'd pronounce, you know, I was literally just kind of back announcing songs. I wasn't doing anything fancy, but so worried I was going to get a fact wrong. I'd mispronounce someone's name. I wouldn't know, you know, what label or album a song appeared on. So really nervous about getting things right, but also just sounding confident and like I was in command of the show, basically. So didn't make any drastic errors in that first show. Did a couple of more of those, but it was very different than being on air and suddenly doing interviews with people. That was much more nerve-wracking. But now, I don't even think about getting nervous anymore. Like, I've done live radio for around about 9 or 10 years, and I still love doing it, but I don't, literally very little nerves before I sort of hit that button on the desk these days.
And that red button is the one that says on air.
On air.
So you know you're live. So one thing I guess we don't see a lot of, and we just saw a live example of, is the things that sometimes can go wrong or that can rattle you that we can't see in radio. Are you prepared to share any of those horror stories?
Yeah, I mean, none have been too traumatizing, but there was actually one just this Monday gone that was less than ideal. So I'd normally have 5 or 6 guests over 3 hours on the Monday morning. And one of them dropped out on the morning I had the show. And I mean, it's a community radio station. I'm a volunteer broadcaster. I could just play more music, but I kind of don't want to do that. Like, I want to cover issues and talk about things that really matter to people in the current moment. So I didn't have time to line up anything while I was sort of getting ready, writing to the station. I was thinking, all right, what can I talk about? And then once the show started, I did the first interview, went to a little bracket of songs, which, you know, went for maybe sort of 10 minutes or so, and then started madly scrambling to find someone who could fill that that space. And I'd noticed, like, this was coming just off the back of that horrific stabbing in Bondi. And I saw some kind of chatter online about the nature of the news media reporting and speculating about who perpetrated those attacks. And one of the things, as well as kind of the, you know, racial ethnic background of the person, was how mental health was being used as a justification or maybe a reason. And, you know, there's really important guidelines media organizations need to follow with that sort of stuff in terms of terminology and not stigmatizing people with certain mental health conditions. So I found a researcher actually here at Melbourne Uni who'd written the guidelines for MindFrame, which provides a great lot of resources for journalists in reporting on those sorts of things. Sent her a text. She was keen to come on, but wanted to make sure the angle wasn't going to be, you know, too specific to that incident. So jumped on the phone, literally while the music's playing, set her mind at ease. She came on an hour later and did an interview. So that just kind of, you know, that's not a usual situation, but it felt much better to me talking about an issue that was very timely rather than just playing another half hour of songs. Like, the show would have gone on otherwise. But yeah, that sort of had to happen behind the scenes while I was still padding and talking and getting everything else sorted.
So we're still talking about live radio, and yeah, you've got a lot of control because it is your own show. And you spoke then about an example of so many other considerations that you have to deal with really sensitive subject matter. How do you see and balance and feel about that power and that responsibility?
I think about it a lot. And I mean, this became particularly pronounced during COVID, I guess. And we have a text line at the station, so you get immediate feedback about your broadcasting. A lot of it, you know, Triple R listeners tend to be fairly friendly, I think. It might be positive or just, you know, a thought that's occurred to them as they've been listening to you. But during sort of COVID and sort of phone calls and feedback we'd get, some of it was quite nasty and, you know, people were having a really tough time out there. So I guess I was just really conscious of how to navigate interviews around, for example, people might remember like the kind of anti-mandate protests happening in Melbourne. Again, sort of making sure that we're talking about issues and, you know, acknowledging, for example, the role of kind of far-right agitators in trying to capitalise on that discontent, but also not suggesting that anyone who goes out in the street to protest is a loony or is crazy. And I was really careful about not wanting to stigmatise people. But, you know, you kind of, you get that immediate feedback, but then you decide what to do with it. You think, all right, was I a bit off in the way that I, my line of questioning? Did I use the wrong word? I reflect on that, I listen back and then decide whether it's something I want to take on board or can just go, they heard something different to what I actually said, so I feel comfortable in my process. And that's actually a good thing to do, like not to take feedback too poorly initially. Like, it can be quite confronting, but it's worth reflecting, I find, on, well, what might that person have heard in what I said? How did that might explain their sort of response to it.
How do you think about your role as the presenter, the facilitator, the interviewer? Do you assume a character? Are you yourself? How do you establish trust with the audience? And I guess, who do you decide to be?
Good question. Yeah, I think my on-air radio persona is a slightly more amped up version maybe than I normally am. And I think that's probably a good trick for, you know, most of us who might be trying out podcasting or radio for the first time, is you do need to sort of just dial up your enthusiasm, your emotion a little bit. I think when I talk in everyday speech, I tend to be a little bit more than monotone, but on radio, I've sort of made a conscious effort over the years just to sound a little bit more lively and to kind of express emotion at the right time so that it sort of resonates with listeners a bit more. So it's not a false version of me, but it's a slightly different performative version of me, I guess.
How do you feel about, I guess, having to be somewhat of a personality? And I guess this migrates through to thinking about audio as podcast. It's, we think particularly about the role of the presenter for the success of a podcast.
Yeah.
Presenter sometimes as personality. How do you feel about that with your journalistic training?
Yeah, well, that's like, I made a podcast for my PhD research, which you might sort of talk about a little bit, but I made a pilot episode for a new podcast, which was all about the state of Australia's democracy, basically. And I'm still sort of making the other episodes for that. But for a narrative podcast, it's, you know, it's extra important that you are kind of a character in the story because you need to give listeners a reason to keep listening. They want to be with you on that journey. So for that, like, I made that sort of pilot episode over the course of probably a year and a half. And a lot of that time was spent just kind of getting comfortable with the kind of person I was going to be in that podcast, because it was still a slightly amplified version of, you know, myself. But on a live radio show, like, I might share a little bit about my personal life, but it's much more important for a narrative podcast to kind of make sure you're giving someone a sense of who you are right at the get-go. So that went to, you know, how I might talk about my sort of my family background, the kinds of things I'm into. And that was much more strategic in just like dropping in these little hints as to what my sort of character or personality is to try to engage a listener. So I experimented with that a lot. And I think that's a really powerful way through audio storytelling and podcasting to potentially engage the audience. But there is an underside to that where there's the cult of character and personality, and that can be sometimes deployed for nefarious political ends as well. So
well, we talk about podcasting as being a really personalised form of storytelling, and that's some examples of that, and also quite emotional. To get that engagement and connection. Does that compromise, I guess, the impartiality approach of particularly of journalism and its, you know, democratic function?
I don't think it needs to. I think actually showing the human side of stories is really important, and even showing the human side of journalists can be really important as well. So I don't think it necessarily impinges on or challenges impartiality. I think there's great examples of kind of, you know, neutral, unbiased journalism that still uses character and personality as a way of telling those stories. But I suppose a question for me as I've studied news podcasts is to what end is that being used? And is it sort of simply to engage the audience to create a mega hit podcast where news organisations or media organisations can sell lots of advertising space versus how is this trying to connect with an audience in a way that actually might benefit democracy or benefit society and culture? And that's sort of where my research comes in. It's not so much about how this can be deployed to generate money, but more how it can encourage the right kinds of interactions, social connections to build a better kind of society and democracy. And that's not always going to be the focus of news organisations who have, you know, commercial imperatives driving a lot of their business. But I think it's a really important question to consider with a relatively new kind of fresh medium.
Well, I know that you've written and researched a lot about thinking about trust and the erosion of trust in democratic institutions, what that means for democracy. What's the place of journalism podcasts in terms of that idea of trust, trust in democracy, trust in society, trust maybe in each other too?
Well, I think it can be really powerful. And this is what came out of my research, because one thing that fascinates me about podcasting, and this is actually what sort of drove a lot of the early research and my interest in the medium and as a form of journalism, was the fact that people tend to listen for quite a long period of time. Like, still, I think the average podcast episode length is 35-ish minutes or so. It's gone down slightly, but people, you know, often will listen right to the end of the episode. Then there's the crazy, you know, 4-hour-long podcast that people can listen to as well. But that sort of runs against the way a lot of our media ecosystem has evolved, where often news is trying to grab our attention for a few seconds or a few minutes via different kinds of social media platforms, you know, TikTok, X, Twitter, whatever it might be. So there's something potentially really powerful, I think, in the fact that people are willing to engage with audio for a long time. And there's also something that I personally, well, and research backs this up as well, really powerful about the fact you know, often listen through headphones or earbuds. You have someone's voice literally inside your own head, and you relate to them almost like they're your friend or someone you're sort of very familiar with. So in that respect, when good quality journalism is harnessing those attributes of podcasting to produce, you know, good output that can benefit society and democracy, I think there's real sort of merit in that. But again, the flip side is, because people are listening to podcasts for a long time, doesn't mean that the content itself is responsible, is worthwhile, isn't maybe driven by some other political or commercial agenda. So that's the sort of tension, I guess.
And I guess that is also the flip side in terms of the power of podcasting for mobilising political action. Do you want to speak a little bit about what the concern of that is?
Yeah, well, I guess something that's interesting, at least in like the research I've read, that podcasting doesn't seem to have been so influential in galvanizing the sort of conspiracy theory, you know, populist right wing kind of movements that have sprung, you know, in places like the United States, for example. It's been other social media platforms where certain identities have managed to gain sort of traction. Podcasting is sort of part of that broader digital media ecosystem, I guess. But at least from what I've read, it doesn't seem to have been a primary tool for mobilizing people in that way. And I'm not really sure why. Like, I guess in Australia, we've got certain podcasts that, you know, might be driven by those kinds of agendas, but they don't, at least to my knowledge, attract huge audience numbers. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing, though, because I do think it's such a powerful medium. But maybe it's the fact that we listen alone, you know, via headphones predominantly. What you then do with that information is another story, but it is quite an intimate sort of media engagement practice, I guess.
Well, back to, I guess, the positive storytelling. You know, you love a conversation and that long-form style. How can that be deployed in terms of the podcast format to be able to help serve democracy? What's that social function that you see it serving?
Yeah, well, actually, I did some interviews with news podcast listeners as part of my research. And one of the things that came out of that was that, and I was kind of asking people about their podcast listening experience, but also what they think about democracy, what level of trust they have in our political institutions and the like. And some of those people actually said that they find the conversational, discursive format of a podcast much more beneficial in terms of giving them even a deeper, broader sense of some of our political leaders. And they were saying they'd really turned off the adversarial style that's been sort of, characterised political journalism for quite a long time, because they didn't really feel they learned anything new out of it. But if they could hear a politician, even one they, you know, vehemently disagree with, in a podcast explaining a bit about why they might have had to come to their position, then at least they have more of a sense of who they are and why they believe what they do. And that could actually help to cultivate trust in them or even in their decisions if they don't necessarily agree with them. So that was interesting to me in terms of just the conversational format of a podcast, which is very common, in allowing us to maybe build trust in journalism or different institutions as well, potentially.
I think you've written a bit too about judgment, that we're very quick to judge others, that it's not just news that has a negative bias, it's a natural human suspicion of others, I suppose. Yeah. Which is a long way around to get to a project you actually did as a student. So let's rewind. And I guess that spirit of openness with which you approached a feature that you did, a half hour, that got to air on Radio National called Big Cats in the Bush. Would you like to explain what that's about and I guess why you wanted to do that story?
Yeah, well, this was one of the experiences that kind of unlocked my passion for radio and audio storytelling, really. So I had this sort of master's project. I was taking a narrative audio storytelling class. And I can't remember if there was a particular topic or a brief that we had to work to, but basically, you know, I just heard all these stories of panthers being out in the Australian bush. And if you speak to a few different people, like, you're bound to find someone who has allegedly seen one or believes they're out there or whatever. So this whole mythology is kind of built up over years that there's these big panthers roaming the Australian bush, but there's been no actual evidence found for them. There's been a number of government inquiries and nothing conclusive. You know, some things that leave the door slightly ajar, they could be there, but, you know, no bones, no skeletons, anything like that. So, you know, very unlikely they're out there. But I was fascinated more in the way that this mythology had sort of taken off, and the fact there were some people I discovered who spent a lot of time trying to find evidence for them off their own bat. And I just thought this was a nice little kind of, you know, human interest story, following some people around to get a sense of why they almost want to believe or want to have it clarified or verified that these big cats are out there. So I tracked down these people who were really keen to tell their story, and basically spent a day with them. So they had planted a dead sheep in the bush a week earlier. And on the day I went out with them, we were going to retrieve these SD cards from cameras they'd set up all around the dead sheep to see if there was, you know, finally evidence of this big cat. So I went and met them, you know, recorded our interactions as they ate breakfast, headed out in the road with them. We collected the SD cards, then took them back to their house to see if they had actually discovered evidence for the big cat. Half the SD cards didn't work, and a lot of the photos were just of us approaching this big dead sheep that, you know, had been totally devoured by something. Then we had this moment where they started to show something there, and it was this massive, quite amazing eagle that had come down and eaten this sheep. So, yeah, it was just a really fun, fascinating story. But, I mean, one of the things that I was really careful about with that one is not to just lampoon these guys because, look, they were lovely and their whole friendship was built, had been built for the over the years around their passion for this creature, alleged creature. And so I took a lot of time and effort to sort of make sure I wasn't making them look really silly, but also was capturing their personality and that kind of thing as well. And look, afterwards, it's interesting, they did get in touch and said, oh, we weren't quite sort of necessarily happy with it. And I was really, you know, I was very fresh then, very green. And I called them up and said, oh, I want to talk about this because, you know, why? And they said, oh, you know, actually, the way you presented it was fine. We're just very sensitive about our stories being out in the public arena because people do make fun of us. But then they said, actually, there's nothing you did that made us look ridiculous. We're just, you know, we get ridiculed a lot, basically. So then we had this sort of session where we talked about it and they're actually ultimately came to the position they were happy with it. But that was a good process to go through because you do need to be really careful about how you tell those stories. And I was really grateful that by the end, they actually accepted that what I'd done was fine. It was more just about even their sort of discomfort of hearing their own voices on radio, which is quite common as well. So
you'd also spent quite a lot of time with them. Like, just paint us a picture, I suppose, is what it took to get that story because you're building a relationship at the same time, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I caught up with them. One of them had co-written this book about the history and mythology of big cats in Australia, and it was nominated for, I think, the Premier's Literary Award. So that happened to be on around the time I was trying to get this story up. So I went and met them down at Fed Square and had a coffee and did a bit of a pre-interview. So we kind of cultivated that relationship early on. And at that point, I don't think I'd quite locked in the day to go out with them into the bush. But, you know, we developed a bit of a rapport, talked about what the story could be, and then, yeah, went out sort of a couple of weeks later and did the story.
Now, when you say went out, I think you could paint a slightly more geographic picture.
Well, I don't think I can be specific, but
how,
it was
how far did you have to go?
It was in the Otway Ranges that we went to, so out in kind of what southwestern Victoria, I guess, a few hours outside Melbourne. That's one of the areas that's been a hotspot for sort of big cat sightings. There are some other places around Victoria as well, but yeah, it was a couple of hours outside Melbourne.
What's it though about building that relationship? You've got to establish rapport for somebody to trust you to share their story. You build that relationship over time, and then often the end of our exchange is when it has gone to air, whereas for them that's the beginning.
Exactly, yeah.
That process of being accountable after it's gone to air or maintaining a relationship, how do you see that?
I think it's really important, and especially when people are lending you their stories. Like, I think that's, you know, the story I told in that example has brought a sort of public interest. It's a curious tale. It's still kind of fun to listen to, even these many years later. But, you know, their voices are kind of in that forever potentially as well. So I think being able to have that sort of debrief afterwards and making sure that you are being really responsible in the stories as you're portraying them. And I mean, this is something I've engaged with around sort of even more sensitive topics with the podcast I've made for the PhD, which is not out yet, but, you know, with people recently out of prison where they were telling me quite sort of harrowing stories of their experience. And I've still stayed in touch with them even still, and I will as it comes out, you know, just to check in to make sure they're in a place where they'll still be sort of okay with that story being told. So I think it's not possible in every situation, of course, but, you know, I always, to the best of my ability, try to make sure we leave on a positive note and have some kind of relationship going forward, or could have a relationship going forward.
What advice would you have had for student Dylan, who had no idea what he was yet going to do?
Oh, good question. I mean, I don't know. I think probably like that story, the big cat story, was so much fun to produce. I think it would have been great to have done more of that stuff early on. Like I found myself doing a lot of live radio at Triple R, and then I actually got a job behind the scenes, a full-time job as a producer. So that's kind of part of this story as well, I guess. I was behind the scenes producing other shows, making sort of sure they went to air and were the best version of themselves I could be, basically. And so I just did a lot of live radio over that time around that full-time job. But I think doing more of the narrative stuff probably would have been a good thing, just because that's still an abiding passion. But it takes a lot of time to do narrative audio. It's very resource intensive, very time intensive. So if that's something that, you know, I would have said to myself I really wanted to do, find a way of factoring that more into your life.
That was Dylan Bird talking to Bernadette Nunn. The yarn is from the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne. It's produced on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Our executive producer is Louisa Lim. This episode was written by Thomas Phillips. Mixing and editing was by me, Elliot Rodriguez. See you next week.